side of all massive world, 15% all the massive world.
No, well, what paper?
Yeah. We'll be doing the presentation proposals now, 11B right. to 11D.
All right. And also, just a quick overview.
We know what the issues are.
Okay. Moving on to presentation now. Agenda papers 11B through to 11D. 11B is just information only, background and overview of responses. I'm not going to cover that one. Agenda paper 11C addresses the presentation of the service cost, finance cost, and remeasurement components. We'll talk about the presenting the service cost and the finance components first. There was quite a bit of support for presenting those components in the profit or loss. Well, everyone supported that. However, there were concerns about how the finance cost component would be presented within profit or loss. And the question really is how prescriptive the board wants to be in presenting the P&L components. The exposure draft proposed that the finance cost component should be presented together with finance costs on the face of the performance statement. So we've identified three alternatives for presenting the finance cost component. One is to rely on the general requirements of IS1, and the second one is requiring finance costs to be presented in the finance cost line item of IS1, which was the approach proposed in the exposure draft, or requiring a separate presentation of the components on the profit or loss. We recommend that the board does not require mandatory disaggregation of the finance cost component on the face of the performance statement. We don't think, although it's material to many entities, we don't think there is a reason to single post-employment benefits out for special treatment on the face of the statement. We don't think the arguments presented in the comment letters justify the inclusion of an additional mandatory line item in IS1. And also we think that if the entity and its users think that information about pensions is sufficiently important, IS1 already permits an entity to provide disaggregated information on the face of the performance statements. Does anyone have any questions?
I couldn't give a right one. I have to check it out with the right.
I don't know. Say, you were talking about question 1B.
Yes.
So, why, if so, why you have to separate the service cost and the finance cost? And it could be combined in one line, so we will not require anything. So how to keep the comparability, and it seems to be totally mess.
Totally
mess.
Mess.
So I have, you know, I'm dissenting the separate. I agree with the separation of the three components and to provide this information as part of a note. But say on the face of income statement, I think it should be shown in one line. That is my point. But why would that be? So you dare to require to separate three components. But now when it comes to the presentation, you give the preparers the total freedom, because that means that they could separate into two. Or they could put them together. So I'm not quite sure if you allow these kind of things, information, the information related to the service cost and the finance cost, they should look at the notes, I think.
The alternative of, you know, going forward with the exposure draft and requiring that finance cost is presented with finance cost in IS. The difficulty is the finance cost isn't always a finance cost. It can be finance income if the plan's in surplus. But also, IS1 doesn't really define what finance cost is. And entities at the moment interpret it in different ways.
Some companies say separate in some service cost in sort of the AGM and finance cost as part of the say interest paid or something. Or some companies put them together and part of the AGM. So you require, you allow them to do this kind of thing, so, and the necessary information. So you think that the three components are so important and useful, so that useful information only can be provided by notes, by the notes, I think. So it seems to me that what you are requiring or what you have in mind is that it seems to me totally inconsistent.
Okay, so you don't agree yet. That's it. Pat, and then PK, and Jan.
I wanted to clarify the staff's proposal. If we did not go forward with the proposal in the ED to present finance cost with other finance costs, will we? Is there a disclosure requirement in the notes that the components of pension costs are disaggregated?
Yes, I think so. Well, we didn't cover it before, but
sure.
there was something in there. We have the reconciliation, number one, but also I think we have to disclose which items have been presented in comprehensive income. So I think it's there.
So you are requiring somehow the PAC to get the service cost, the unwinding of the discount and the actuarial.
Yeah.
You know, some sort of rough.
Yeah.
And will the basis for conclusion still make it clear that the board believes that those components are of a different nature?
Well, that's why they've been disaggregated.
That's what I'm trying to establish, that if we... So what exactly we're doing when we support the staff's position? Is it just that we're not specifying where on the face of the statement these go, or are we abandoning the notion that they're of a different nature?
No, I think, let me try and clarify where we're coming from. These items have been disaggregated, and service costs and finance costs are going to be presented in profit or loss. However, the question is how prescriptive we want to be in that presentation. Different entities are going to have different performance statements based on what's relevant to them within the bounds of what IS1 allows. For instance, I think a lot of the banks commented that we shouldn't be requiring the finance cost component to be put together with their other interest costs, because that's what they're concerned about. That's one of their main performance drivers, and they don't want to see the two put together. They want to be able to split them apart. And it's how specific we want to be in prescribing where those components should be presented, which line item, and what we're saying is entities should be allowed to present them within the bounds of IS1, however is most relevant to them. We're not saying they should be presenting them in two different components, or they should be aggregating them together and putting them in one component. we're just saying just rely on IS1 for the presentation of those components within profit or loss.
BK? No. Don?
Well, I think what we had in the ED was good. I think we should stick to that. The reason for that is that there are twofold. First of all, this is a financial expense in my mind. You can have this expense or you can substitute it and buy yourself out of your obligation by borrowing money from the bank. And then you're moving between operating and financial, whatever you call it. I also think it's important that we give a direction because here different entities have different views. And here we really have a rather substantial amount, which some like to put here and some would like to put there. Just a matter of taste. I don't think it is a better way of presenting the business. And as I said, I think this is financial expense or financial income. I think most of the income should go into finance if we have income.
And here's my
problem. Well, can solve anything.
It is not that simple, and the experience we have had on the FSP project where we had to further disaggregate finance costs and recreate the financing category within operating income to highlight the financing coming from operating activities show that there is a little bit more complexity to where those things should go. So maybe that we should not mandate where to classify in the P&L. We should just say that the disaggregation should be either on the face or in the notes. And in the notes, you should explain where in the P&L you have classified the elements which you have disaggregated in the notes.
This has been one of the biggest complaints from investors, I think, particularly those using IFRS, is that this particular line item that we have at the moment can either be as part of operating or below the operating profit line. And it creates such annoyance that you can't compare operating profits because of that. Now, that's not something perhaps we can solve here, and it really requires financial statement presentation and definition of what is operating.
Yeah.
I think the banks sort of misinterpreted what we were trying to do. They sort of looked at it and said, oh, you're going to require us to put it in our interest margin. I didn't think we were ever intending that. What we wanted, I thought, was simply to describe it as related to financing. And I think perhaps we can find a way of saying that this is a financing item, that's how we view it, but I don't think we can then specify where it goes in the income statement because, well, we just don't do that in IS1 anyway for the vast majority of costs. So I think the next stage has to be solved by financial statement presentation.
So you support the recommendation, Steve?
Yeah, I reluctantly I do support it because I don't see
any
other way given where we are in IS1.
Okay, can I put, Paul? Would
you permit a bank to put the pension financing cost in that interest margin?
If
they want to?
Well, we don't define net interest margin at the moment, do we? Yeah. So bank can put whatever they want.
No sensible bank would put it, number one. So
if they want to tell a story, they might.
You'd be surprised what some of the banks
I would prohibit it myself. Or just require it to be disclosed separately.
Well, that requires more.
I know.
Yeah.
To prohibit, okay. You have to conceptualize before.
Let me put the question, the recommendation. We don't specify, first of all, we present service costs and finance costs in P&L. We don't specify where they go. Who would agree with that? Okay, that's 13.
Okay.
Question two?
Move on to presenting the remeasurements components. The board proposed that the remeasurements component should be presented in OCI. We've identified four alternatives for the board to consider in presenting the remeasurements components. In identifying these alternatives, we've thought about what was in the ED, what's currently in IS19, and also the other decisions that the board has made regarding OCI and IFRS 9. The four approaches are the P&L approach requiring remeasurements presented separately in profit or loss. The OCI approach requiring presentation of the remeasurement components in OCI. The P&L option approach, which permits a choice between presenting the remeasurement components in OCI or presenting it separately in profit or loss. And the P&L mismatch approach. And this approach requires presentation of the remeasurements in OCI unless presenting it in OCI would create a mismatch in profit or loss, in which case the entity would have to present the remeasurements in profit or loss. Summarizing what our analysis is, the profit and loss approach does not use OCI, and therefore the board does not need to address any other issues that arises due to using OCI. However, very few respondents supported this approach in the feedback on the exposure draft. The OCI approach presents separately amounts with different predictive value and is therefore more understandable. A majority of respondents supported the approach in the exposure draft. The profit and loss approach would be maintaining the status quo. However, it will be perpetuating options, and the board has stated previously that in order to improve comparability, the objective would be to reduce the options. The P&L mismatch approach addresses some of the concerns that arise that people have with presenting remeasurements in OCI, such as the requirement to present these amounts for small plans or for an unfunded plan which holds assets, which are presented, whose gains and losses are presented through the loss. On balance, we've recommended the board confirm the approach in exposure draft, which is to present the remeasurements components in other comprehensive income. Does anyone have any comments?
Anyone disagree with that? We've been through this several times.
Yeah. Well, we have views, but
PK and then Steve.
I think Manuel should be complimented for giving an explanation, number one, in para 20 for the IFRS 9, and why we did what we did in IFRS 9. You should be absolutely complimented with the theory that you came up, and then financial emotional income. That's not the point. I just wanted to compliment you for coming up with an explanation after the fact, but be that as it may. The point I want to make here is that I think when we started discussing this project last year, there was a board discussion whether we should show the actuarial gains or losses somehow in income statement, net of something, and we fiddled around with that thought process for a while. Then we moved on to the OCI. I do agree that in general we should not have too many options, but here I think removing the option that is there in existing IAS 19, which is a P&L option, is not an imminent idea to eliminate. I suggest for various reasons that we should keep the P&L option open, and I do know some jurisdictions have mandated in their financial statements before adopting into IFRS or converging into IFRS to book all the actual gains and losses through income statement. By removing this and putting it in OCI in the name of comparability would be, in my mind, taking away a good accounting answer. And I would recommend that we should keep the P&L option approach alive till we decide what is a OCI and all that good stuff. And I think it's too premature to remove the option here. So I think I don't agree with the staff proposal because I would like to add P&L option approach into this.
Okay. It would be all P&L?
Yeah. If it's an option. Yeah, there are some jurisdictions who would like to put all in P&L.
I thought you might have been talking about realized as well. Steve?
I support OCI, but I think I'm looking at the P&L mismatch here. I think there are two situations where just dumping it all on it into OCI can create a problem. You have an unfunded plan where the sponsor has assets which are earmarked for pension payments on its balance sheet, and you've got the fair value changes of those assets in the P&L and offsetting actuarial gains and losses in OCI. That doesn't make a great deal of sense. And the other is situations where the sponsor puts on hedges of its exposure to pension risk, so a longevity swap which is held by the sponsor, an interest rate swap that changes the duration mismatch, again, in the sponsor's financial statements. Now I mean, this creates a further problem because we're not allowing the hedge accounting to apply to items in OCI, so you can't deal with it that way. And to my mind, in these situations that I'm describing, the only way to get effective offset and sensible accounting is to then use this P&L mismatch approach. I guess my question is, how much of a problem is this in practice? The situations I've described, is that an issue, a significant issue in practice, or am I just sort of creating a theoretical problem? And
well, there were the people that came up with, there were only a few commentators that noted these issues. It wasn't a very large set of problems coming through the comment letters, but I'm not sure how much of an issue, because we didn't really ask a specific question on that. I'm not sure how much of an issue it is in general. But I think the second example that you noted, Stephen, one about the hedging done at the corporate level, that didn't come through the comment letters actually, but I've heard that a few entities that do that. I don't know how pervasive that is, but it's definitely out there, I think.
Yeah. The precedent, the on credit risk liabilities go to OCI, and I don't remember maybe except when there is a mismatch, and then it goes to P&L. And we have a precedent about the mismatch asset liabilities with your own credit risk. So that will bring some water to your mill, using a French expression.
The difficulty with the difficulty we'll probably have to develop criteria for when that mismatch would occur, and that might take more time.
And you may have to re-export. Okay, Pat.
I support PK in leaving the alternative. Ordinarily, I object to alternatives because they do create a lack of comparability. But in this case, I believe we are eliminating the alternative that is the best accounting solution, because including everything in P&L helps Stephen with his problem of the mismatch. You don't have to worry about recycling. We're not allowing recycling, but some people believe things should be recycled, so that's off the table. And there's a whole host of reasons why including P&L is better. And I'd like to point out that Honeywell today announced that it is changing its pension accounting and recognizing its gains and losses in P&L immediately.
Okay, John.
Same view. If it doesn't carry, I would be happy to see that we at least discuss this mismatch matter, but I would be very happy to support it to a right.
Yeah,
I will support to maintain options. As I explained in the past, for other industry, I don't have any problems, but for manufacturing companies, it seems useless to split the remeasurement part from their cost of inventory. And take GM as example. In the past, they experienced huge problems of the pensions. But if we cut, let's assume, 50 or 30% of the pension costs, we call the remeasurement from their cost of inventory. I don't think the cost information is useful. And this is major reasons why I will prefer maintain the options, mainly for the manufacturing companies. If you not include all the costs, it seems useless information.
Who's next? Is it Tatsu?
We know what you're going to say.
Sorry?
We know what you're
getting. Oh, yeah. So,
he's talking
but I'd like to confirm what I have in mind. So, obviously, I support that everything should be recognized as part of net income. And I could live with the sort of the P&L option, the lifetime fee. But the trouble with using the OCI is I'm not quite sure what the remain the part which is recognized as OCI. That mean I do not understand the meaning, because they say if the return on actual return on plan asset is say 2%, and discount rate is 3%, in that case we regard 3% should be recycled to net income and recognized as OCI minus 1% in that case. So why we should regard, say, as long as the matching the life of DBO and also the plan asset, why plan asset should be recognized in income gains of 3%, which is the exactly the same as the discount rate. I do not understand the logic.
Don't recycle, you screw up.
Sorry? Yeah. But say, and then meaning of the minus 1%, what it means.
Yeah.
So that is my trouble of this OCI approach.
Okay, the strongly in favour of the OCI position. This has been run in the UK now for 10 years. We have never had any questions about mismatches, and there's over 3,000 companies use this at the moment. I don't like options. I think we should get rid of them. My personal view is that long-term gains and losses should not be in P&L. And the reason I'm very strongly about that is when we had the exposure draft in the UK in 97, I think I've mentioned this several times, and the stock market swung quite dramatically, 25%. Barclays would have shown operating profit about 2 billion minus 3 billion in the pension fund swing, because the asset values fell. The next year all came back again, so they'd have 2 billion operating profit plus 3 billion. So their profits would have been a loss of 1 billion in year one and a profit of 5 billion in year two, whereas what happened is their operations were 2 billion both years and the pension fund swung. And I think that's how we should show it. I think the analysts will pull that number back out again if you stick it in the P&L account. I'm totally opposed to it going in there. And I just don't think it's a fair reflection of what's happened. Everything goes in there. It's comprehensive income, I think, is the real sort of picture of showing everything. Okay, any other
David, question for you?
Make me too.
If I sell a fixed asset, would you put it in OCI then?
Yes. Yeah, he always does.
He would put fixed asset sale also.
Do that. Oh, it's just the sale. He put the revaluation into
it. No,
I would put the sale as well.
Sale.
Oh, would you put the sale as well?
Okay.
He always did that.
Okay.
How do you solve the question that's in the next paper on this being part of your cost?
Because okay, so
I'm just not seeing how you...
It depends what the other standard says. Hmm? It depends what the other standard says. I think the answer is right. If the standard allows you to put it into inventory, you do that. It's just going to go through the P&L account. It doesn't mean anything to me.
But should we amend IS2?
Could do. But I don't think many people are usually putting swings, violent swings in the pension fund through into inventory. These things move a lot. You don't?
Yeah, I know.
They move hugely.
I'm in Tatsumi's camp and have been all along. I think it should all go through P&L, notwithstanding David's concern. However, I could live with an option, reluctantly, and I don't think we'd have to re-expose it.
I would have sympathy for keeping the option as well, for various reasons. And we are not creating a new one. We have an option today. Is it time to kill it or not? I'm not sure it is time to kill that option.
Okay, any other comments? No, can I put the staff proposal which is it goes in OCI, and if that fails, we come back and go through the others. John?
For support.
Oh, sorry. Those in favour going to OCI? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it fails. Okay, next one, we'll try the option. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Can I
vote
again?
You don't need to bother, it's already there. Okay, we'll go with that one. I think that's ready to say
it. It was 8, wasn't it?
9.
And you're going to dissent?
I think I'm probably. I just don't think we should keep options. That's a massive difference. Huge difference. Put it through P&L. Where's the compatibility in that? We're not talking tiny numbers. We're talking about huge swings.
That probably means that when we talk about OCR, that has particular significance. We need to have it together.
Okay. That be.
Okay, moving on to paper 11D.
Well, ironic that we shouldn't have been recommending something like that. We can start it, Bob.
11D addresses components, whether the components of defined benefit costs should be or can be included in the cost of an asset. It also considers a couple of other issues that arise along with presenting an amount in OCI, that is the subsequent reclassification, the recycling of those amounts, and also whether we should be specifying where the amount should be going in which component those cumulative amounts of remeasurements in OCI should be going in equity. In terms of the what should be included in the cost of an asset, we think that this should really be defined by the standard that contains the requirements for that particular asset, whether that is inventory, property, plants, or equipment. If we want to perhaps consider limiting the components that those standards can capitalize, we can consider what the conclusions that the IFRIC reached in IFRIC 1. In IFRIC 1, the IFRIC concluded that changes in initial estimates of a cost that's included as part of an asset should be added to or deducted from the cost of that asset. And it also concluded that the unwinding of the discounts for that liability for a decommissioning, restoration, or similar liability would not meet the requirements of IAS 23 and therefore not be capitalizable. If we apply the same rationale to the components of defined benefit costs, we'd reach the same conclusion. Now, we think that if we do decide to limit what costs can be capitalized in accordance with another standard, we may need to change those conclusions subsequently when those standards on those assets address the questions of what to do with subsequent remeasurements of the initial estimates used to allocate those costs to the assets. Therefore, we recommend that the board not limit what components should be capitalizable, and therefore entities should be allowed to capitalize whatever the asset that the standard that deals with the asset requires to be included in the cost of that asset. Is there any comments on
the concern I would have with it, I think, is what Alka started to address, is that because if you take your Barclays example, the movements going through NCI can be so, through OCI, can be so significant as to actually distort what you're seeing when you see the asset. Now, I'm not sure that a standard like IS2 would have been written knowing that OCI would be coming about. So I don't think the one conceived or conceptualized the other one.
But
if we're saying that you would read those standards as having already given the entity the choice as to what they, then I'd probably be comfortable with it. But if we assume that they're not written like that, I'm not sure that's right.
I think, just to clarify what I think the issues are, even if we didn't present the remeasurements in OCI, we presented the remeasurements in profit or loss, those remeasurements could be big, the swings could be wild. The question is, should the subsequent remeasurements of those initial costs, should that be added to or deducted to from the cost of an asset? And I don't think that's really a question of whether those amounts are presented in OCI or profit or loss. It's just whatever is required by the other standard.
It's what asset accounting.
It's really beyond the scope of IS 19, I feel.
Yeah, and it's an existing issue today already. It's an issue that we
yeah, it is. Because you got that up.
Can I clarify? Only, say, for the cost of the asset, only the service cost, or say...
only the what cost, that's
Service cost. Or sort of the finance cost is included?
Whatever another standard requires.
Yeah, that's the staff recommendation.
What about IS 23?
The IS 23 on borrowing costs, for instance, it doesn't prohibit, but if RIC 1 interpreted the unwinding of a discount rate to not meet the definition of borrowing costs, now further on down the track, you know, when the board addresses borrowing costs, they might come to a different conclusion.
No, my question is related to the inventory. So currently, I think that under IS 19, only one line is recognized. And in case of the manufacturing companies, they put the, say, cost related to the workers in a factory. Could be all the cost is now part of the inventory, I think. But by having these three categories, now it seems to me what you are suggesting, if I understand correctly, is related to the net income. That means I think that service cost plus finance cost could be to the part of the inventory, but the cost related to the recognized as part of OCI is never be recycled to the cost of the inventory, I think.
What we're saying is whatever the standard on the asset says,
But IS 2 is not clear on that point, I think.
Well, neither is IS 16 or many of the other standards on the asset, which is why this problem arises. However, we don't think that IS 19 is the appropriate place to address that deficiency. We should be addressing it somewhere else.
I understand that point.
So that's why we don't suggest limiting the components to service costs or finance costs or measurements. We just leave it open.
But I have no trouble with that because the country is one line, so we could say it's a pension cost, but now we... Then, say, in terms of the presentation, we divided into two service costs and unwinding the finance cost. And finance cost does not meet the, sort of the cost which could be transferred to the inventory. That is, it seems to be unintended consequence of the, it might change the practice.
But Tatsumi, why doesn't it indicate the answer?
Paul's been trying to get in for ages.
I'm not sure there's a problem that you're identifying, Tatsumi. You say transfer from the one line into inventory, and earlier you said recycle from OCI into inventory. That was your word.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a question of transferring or recycling. The question is, when you incur the cost, is it an employee benefit cost that is capitalizable under IAS-2 in the first place, or IAS-16 if you're building, self-constructing a property? And if it is, it never gets into a line in the income statement to need a transfer in the first place. It just goes, it's a cost of building the machine or making your inventory. So I think, well, you've got to read IAS-2, and I think even what would go in OCI, that is the remeasurement, would be eligible to be an inventory cost, because that's what IAS-2 said. If you want to define it, if it is appropriately defined as an employee benefit cost of the factory worker.
Okay, hang on. There's a whole lot of people trying to get in. So it's Wayne and PK.
I guess my question is whether or not we're getting involved in a lot of cost accounting and bookkeeping. My understanding is that this stuff goes to inventory as part of a standard cost system. Nobody credits salary expense. Nobody credits pension expense. It just gets soaked up in the change in inventory that's absorbed in gross profit. So there's the only way that we would be somehow validating or testing the number would be to say, is 48 cents an hour the right number, or should it be 47 or 49 or whatever? I don't believe, have ever gotten into that level of detail in these things. So Paul's right. It's not a bookkeeping question of something getting credited out. It's just we're telling people, in evaluating how you got to that 47 cent standard cost number, these are the things you have to keep in mind. I'm not sure we can go a lot farther than that, can we? In which case, the staff recommendation of saying let it live in IAS-2 is about the best we can do.
Do you want to say any more?
I just wanted to ask Katsumi, how can presentation dictate capitalization? That's what I was trying to ask you. I understood your objection in the previous paper about whether we should show it, but I don't think presentation dictates the capitalization issue. Capitalization is dictated by 2 or 16 here in this situation. So I think we are mixing two things here in my mind. That's all I wanted to add. I personally think finance costs in this situation should not be capitalized, but that's my personal view. But because of the IAS 23 and its corresponding US GAAP literature on this, but be that as it may, I think somebody said it well. Let us leave it to IAS 2 and 16 to decide what should be capitalized.
Okay. Do we need to discuss this much more?
No.
Okay. Who would disagree with the recommendation? Okay. Question 3. Sorry, no, I'm not. Where are we? Question 2.
Who is going to judge?
Are we moving on?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
This is now about recycling. The board's previously acknowledged that it needs to address, you know, general issues about recycling. However, in the absence of an objective, we don't think that there is a justification for modifying the immediate recognition approach currently in IS-19 and the approach that was proposed in the exposure draft, that is, to prohibit recycling of amounts. Does the board have any comments on that?
Well, unless you want to be totally schizophrenic, having just issued a part of IFRS 9 where we said we're going to stick to our position, and then 2 weeks later we change it, and I think it would be very difficult not to do anything but agree with the staff recommendation.
But take the wording we used for IFRS 9.
Just the same thing. We're not recycling, that's the point.
I should note that, you know, US GAAP does recycle. And
yeah, we know that.
however, if we do recycle, probably still end up at a different answer because we have different amounts going into OCI.
That's assuming we know you're going to ask.
No. Very, very safe. I respond to the poll Paul said some of the, say, gains and losses recognized as OCI could be transferred to the, inventory. But by having this, I think that, from the OCI to IS inventory is not not allowed, I think.
He said it never goes to
OCI. It never gets there.
That's the last question. I agree with you and Wayne.
Okay.
We've finished that question. We've voted on it. We're on to this one. This is recycling. Question two. It's question two we're talking about. You've brought back to the last question.
I have a right to say.
No, you haven't. Not when I've moved on, you haven't. Okay, question two. Tatsumi, you're fired again. Question two. Gone.
I'll support it, but I think that the logic behind it is different than what we had on the IFRS 9. I think here we have a logic that says it's very hard to find the recycling. So I think when we write the basis for this, I would like to see something different than saying that we have a general philosophy whereby we have decided never to recycle. Because we haven't decided that yet, even though it's written in this paper.
Okay.
Okay. Any? Will you?
I think in the previous paper, we decided to maintain option. Then for those companies to select, to provide, to present all in profit loss, there's no such questions.
Only the OCI. But. Okay. Anyone, any other comments? So can we vote? Steve.
I just wanted to say that I think if there's ever a situation that illustrates that recycling is crazy, I think it's this one. I think it's really difficult to think about recycling in a logical fashion in this situation.
But also to Jan's point, I think if you go back into IFRS 9, Jan, we do actually set out a principle. We said that these are items of income and expense and they should be recognised only once. It's in IFRS 9. So the board has voted on that and agreed.
But general principle always to apply. I think when you had the IFRS 9, I accepted that as sort of a very open compromise to get certain parts of the world to think we had a good solution. For only that reason. It was a mistake, most likely, but we make mistakes sometimes.
And while we slightly amended the wording for liabilities and said we leave it up to the framework.
If you go back and read what's in IFRS 9 generally, you'll find that's
we're having that debate on the framework.
We're a little bit schizophrenic in a way, because we have voted in IFRS 9 with the principle. And we say, oh, it's forever, never recycle, only recognize one. At the same time, when we decide what we do on FSP, we say, but we have to think of OCI and recycling. So we are totally schizophrenic in a way.
Well, that's because we have one that is recycled at the moment. We're supposed to have taken out, but it's still there. So we have, our standards aren't consistent. We've got a 20 relic. Okay, can I put the board, the staff recommendation? Who would disagree with it? Okay, thank you. Question three.
This is just on what to do with cumulative amounts already recognized in OCI. The exposure draft and current IS 19 requires that amounts recognized in OCI are transferred immediately to retained earnings. DED just carried forward this existing requirement in IS 19. The board's current thinking in recent projects into IFRS 9 has been to allow an entity to transfer the cumulative gain or loss within equity in the light of jurisdiction-specific restrictions on components of equity, but also because the phrase retained earnings is not really defined. Therefore, the staff recommends that entities should also be permitted but not required to transfer the remeasurements component within equity consistent with the decisions in IFRS 9.
And
I'm not sure whether we should address it or not. I think I don't like to do standards that say you may do something. We don't, in general, address the movements within equity or between OCI and equity. Why make a special case here? And do we need a standard to say you are allowed to do something?
Well, the problem is that, Philip, we've got it in 16, we've got it in 9. If you don't say it, people will say, well, you obviously intend that you can't here. That's the problem.
But some people also think that any amounts which are left in OCI, accumulated OCI, are part of equity. You don't need to have a movement, an explicit movement.
It just stays there forever, that's the...
So what?
Well, there's a question about dividends.
Well,
we're not addressing dividends. Are we ever addressing the issue of dividends?
Why would we preclude a company from transferring to some other category?
I don't want to preclude, or I don't have to preclude or to allow. They will decide based on local legislation whether OCI, accumulated OCI, is part of retail earnings or not. And whether dividends can be paid out is not our job. I mean,
no,
okay.
Okay,
I think generally we have two kinds of OCI, and we will discuss tomorrow the single statement. And for those OCI which will be recycled, I would call them accumulated OCI. Others, I don't like the idea, you know, we prepare profit loss and the net amount will transfer directly to retained earnings. And for this kind of OCI, we now already said this is part of the comprehensive income, only recognized once, and will not be recycled, we just discussed. I would rather prefer to require transfer directly to retained earnings, rather than maintain it and call it accumulated. If we not like to do so, I would support the staff proposal, because in 9 and our recent publications on the liability fair value options will also maintain such a kind of requirement. Otherwise, people will, you know, assume the amount cannot be distributed because of it will be locked somewhere. So my first alternative will be transfer directly, and secondly, support the staff proposal, because it's consistent with the wordings in 9 and consistent with the wordings with the standard we just published.
Thank you. That's it.
Thank you. I have a question. Say, in paragraph 33, that is a staff recommendation. I do not understand the staff recommendations means. Now, I think current proposal is OCI, change in OCI should be recognized as a part of retained earnings. That is a current DED's proposal. But by having said in here, recommend that entities should also be permitted but not required to transfer the remeasurement component within equity, that means say current proposal is a change in OCI remeasurement should be recognized as part of retained earnings. But you, in addition to that, you should allow the entity to put change in OCI in a separate component of the equity as a OCI, like a IS 19 OCI treatment. That is your proposal.
Sorry, I think you might be, because it says entities should also be permitted, are you?
Yeah, I do not understand what you are proposing.
I think we're just proposing to align the requirements with IFRS 9, so an entity would be permitted to transfer the cumulative amounts within equity.
Oh, that means IFRS 9 is a say change in OCI should be recognized as independent component of equity,
right.
And when it is realized, it could be transferred from the OCI to retained earnings. That is not clear, but like IS 16 remeasurement. What is you have in mind?
I think the case is different from IS 16 because in IS 16 there's a requirement to take the revaluation gain to revaluation surplus and keep it there as long as you still have the assets. and then that IS 16 is addressing what happens when you sell the assets. Here, really, when we take these gains through OCI, we don't really care which components of equity they go to. That's up to the entity, in a way, it's up to local legislation to decide which components it goes to. If they want to credit it immediately to some heading, they can do that. If they want to transfer it at some stage in the future, they can do that as well.
It is different.
And it is different from the I-16 case, where it has to stay in the revaluation surplus while you still hold the asset.
But here, the proposal is everything in the change in OCI should be recognized as part of retained earnings. That is the proposal.
Well, that's the current requirements in IAS 19, which you reminded us
of
as we finalized the IED.
But what is recommended is now entity has one more choice. That means a change in OCI could be presented an independent component of the equity. That is the proposal.
I think what we should say is that the current year OCI goes through OCI. Where you put it in equity is up to you.
Yeah.
And also, I think the proposal is that once you've put it as a separate item in equity, in a future period, you could transfer it to
another
earnings if you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you have two choices.
Okay. Yeah. So it is not clear.
No, it's not. Because it starts, it says transfer here, Manuel, and that's what's transfer means. You must have put it someplace elsewhere in the first, in the first time. You could put it directly in retained earnings right at the start, or put it in a separate component and later transfer it. Separate component and never transferred.
So, you want to add anything to this? Oh, we're going to have to move on. We have to be over here at 5 past, apparently.
Well, I was going to say it makes a degree of sense to say it's up to the entity on how it handles reclassifications within equity. There are several unintended consequences if we start specifying when and where. In some jurisdictions, a reclassification is considered tantamount to realization. And that can trigger a whole bunch of other effects, like participating dividends and things like that. So the approach in 16, which was it's up to you how you deal with it after you've sold the asset, probably serves us well, and I would suggest we keep with it because we don't know what all of the possible unintended consequences are.
Okay, can we agree to that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. On to H. Well, the message I've been given is to say that the buses are going to be here at 5 past 5. We have to get back to the hotel, and you have to be in the bus at 5:30 because the buses won't wait. They've got to be back for another appointment. So you've got to dump your stuff in the hotel and be ready at 5:30.
So ask us if we agree.
Okay, Manuel.
That's for coffee, fuel. Those questions.
The first one, paper 11H addresses classification. Now, the first question one is on the classification of post employment and other long term employment benefits. The exposure draft proposes to combine these two categories. The staff recommends that the board keep the existing classifications as they are in IS 19 for the reasons set out in paragraph 6.
I agree. I don't think we thought through this very well when we did the exposure draft. Very
agree.
Let's support the staff. Any disagreements? Okay. That was quick.
Well, the second one isn't going to be as quick as that. But if you just bear with me, clarifying that B, do you propose to clarify the distinction between short-term employee benefits and other long-term employee benefits? There were still some issues that people raised or concerned about what the basis of the classification was meant to be, and whether the words used in the exposure draft got us there. I think views are a bit divided between whether the classification should be based on settlements or whether it should be based on entitlements. I think the staff believe that it should be based on settlements, because that's what the distinction, that's how the measurement under IS 19 works. However, that if the board bases the distinction between short-term and long-term on expected settlements, we get some additional issues that come up, such as what to do when expectations change, what unit of accounts should be used, and whether a single benefit should be divided into components and then classified. We don't think that the benefit should be split up. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And on the reclassification question, the issue is, it's more of an issue for items that were previously classified as short-term and no longer meet that definition, since carrying forward those benefits under that classification would wind up measuring those benefits at an amount that they shouldn't be measured at. However, the unit of account issue is a bit more tricky. We have to keep in mind we don't want to create more problems that we're trying to solve. The issue is what sets of benefits should be classified. IS 19 doesn't currently specify what the unit of account classification should be. It does specify that for personal employment benefits to use the unit of account of a plan. However, it's not very specific about what a plan is. We do think that all benefits from a specific benefit type should be the same classification. And that all the benefits of that benefit type should meet the definition of a short-term benefit to meet that classification criteria. I should mention that I did contact the Employee Benefits Working Group on this issue, because it is a bit of a difficult one. The responses were quite supportive of basing the distinction on expected settlements. Some of them suggested that one possible approach could be to combine the two categories to eliminate the distinction between short-term and long-term, and just require discounting if the effective time value of money is going to be material, similar to what is done in IS 37. However, I think at this point we should just get your views on what the basic classification should be, whether it should be on expected settlements or entitlements, and if it's on expected settlements, whether the whole of the amounts resulting from that benefit type should have to be required to meet the definition of a short-term benefit.
Okay. Any views to the contrary?
I'm happy to agree.
Okay, agreed.
Okay.
And the second one, that you should revisit it if it no longer met the definition. Does anyone disagree with that? Okay, that's a good tactic. See, this is going to take a long time.
Manuel?
Yeah.
You indicated in your paper that you didn't think it was necessary for the board to discuss or talk about the unit of account, that we shouldn't be specific.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering whether or not the board agrees with that because you didn't pose that question to them and how critical that is to their decision on the expected value.
The unit of account is a bit tricky, and I didn't want to get into the details of the specific scope of what a benefit type is, etc. I think it's quite clear the board wants it to be on a benefit type. However, in terms of how we're going to implement that in the standard, we'll probably have to think about that, whether we use the construct of the plan or whether we word the requirement to capture that. However, I don't think it's that big of an issue at the moment in practice. Some people did raise it in response to this, mostly the accounting firms, in order to make it a bit clearer and to reduce any potential diversity in practice. However, I'm not sure how diverse practice is at the moment. We didn't get too much feedback in the comment letters, so I'm not sure how much of an issue it is out there at the moment.
So I think it's a scoping issue, really, which is the issue we set out to solve this particular issue was whether there was expectation of a settlement or entitlement to the dividing line. The question of what the unit of account is largely a separate issue, of course, in scope, and I think it will, we don't know how much work would be involved to try and bring it in at this stage post-ED, when we always said that the things we would deal with in this project were the things we could deal with quickly. So.
It's just you said that it's pretty clear the board had benefit type in mind, and I don't know whether that's very clear, but I think that's a good place to be in terms of the unit of account. But I was just curious whether or not that was in fact the case.
Okay. Could I just remind you, you have to bring your name tabs tomorrow morning to get into the building, so if you could make sure you have those with you. And as I mentioned before, the bus at 5:05, we need to be downstairs for that, and we want to be back in the bus at 5:30.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Manuel.
Thank you.
Thanks for your help.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you. Sorry, the paper you've just got now is the draft of the joint update, and it's the same as the last update except for the yellow section. So all it's doing is just highlighting the bits we've updated from last time. It's for a point of reference for tomorrow morning's discussion.
I've given my tour or my call for two of you. It's enough for today.
I'm getting very concerned that you've spread your call wrong.
Yeah,
that's true.
I'm not going to say it.
Yeah,
just watch me.